Hi folks, I am Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix.
Let's go into one of the main characters, a member of the Royal Society and every other great society, and no doubt took many, many oaths. To lead the world through argument along this particular route, that's how they do it. And this is by the grandson of Charles Darwin. It's called The Next Million Years by Charles Galton Darwin. He spends a lot of the book, again, comparing man with animals and saying, my God, you know, they'll outbreed and they won't have the food and yada, 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 and all this kind of stuff. But his big thrust is the wrong kinds will breed. He makes no bones about that. He says it openly. It's the wrong kind who will breed, you know. And he actually mentions the wrong kind. He actually couches it too, if you're going a lot further. He says here, in page 93, he says, a man is promoted on account of his individual merits without any thought about the consequences for the distant future. In a less abnormal world than the present, his increased prosperity should lead to a man's having a larger family and those of the less prosperous, so that the good qualities inherited from him, the one with the most money, should gradually become diffused throughout the population in later generations. In the present time, the exact opposite happens all too often, in that he's likely to have a smaller family than the average. In fact, success in life is at present antagonistic to success in survival. Then he goes on to talk about parasites and so on, and how even parasites have a function. He says, it's always necessary to remember that nature itself is quite non-moral, and that there are many qualities by which we no means admire, which nevertheless are often regrettably effective in the struggle for life. All through the animal kingdom, one of the most successful roles is that of the parasite. And there are states of human society where such a parasite as a professional beggar is as successful as anyone else. Something of the kind is unfortunately true in Britain today, or just now. It says the people we are really encouraging are not those that we think we are. For a great many of the people who get good promotion are contributing less to their share to the next generation. He said, at present, the most efficient way for a man to survive in Britain is to be almost half-witted. He said, that's what he thinks of the public. The profane, you see. Completely irresponsible and spending a lot of time in prison, where his health is far better looked after than outside. On coming out with restored health, he's ready to beget many further children quite promiscuously, and these problem children are then beautifully cared for by the various charitable societies and agencies until such time as they have grown old enough to carry on the good work for themselves. It is this parasitic type that is at present most favoured in our country. If nothing is done, a point will come where the parasite will kill its host by exhaustion, and then, of course, itself perish miserably and contemptibly through having no one to support it. Now, though there may be occasions in human history when something of this kind can happen, there is no fear that it should happen to mankind as a whole, for a parasite is essentially subordinate to some host. And man claims, and claims reasonably, to be master of the world. There's reason for him to be subordinate too. So there's no danger of mankind adopting the role of the parasite, he says. This character who didn't do much work in his lifetime. Back with more after this break. Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt. We're cutting through the matrix, reading from Charles Galton Darwin's book, The Next Million Years, printed in 1952. I think he himself was a physicist, and he was into eugenics in a big, big scale. I wouldn't say just as a sideline, I think that was really his favourite topic. But he talks about specialising the breeds of humanity, specialising by breeding. And he even suggests at one point that, tongue-in-cheek of course, that if he could only make the women of Britain and maybe the world accept the seed, the sperm of the fit, the aristocratic class like himself, they could breed out all the bad traits of humanity and bring in the good society. But on page 130, after talking about the different benefits of inbreeding as opposed to the demerits of inbreeding as well, he goes on to say this. There may be those who will regret that man will not attain these pinnacles of specialization, that means through breeding. But the failure is inevitable. In order to create such specialist breeds, there would have to be a master breed at the summit. Summit, you see. You know, the Great Pyramid. And this would be a totally different kind of thing from all the other breeds, because it would have to create itself. How would it create itself? Through genetics. Perhaps. Then he goes on to say, at every turn the argument leads back to this question of the master breed. Now remember what Plato talked about in the Republic, the master breed and so on, the guardian class. And how they breed specific humans for special tasks and so on. Just like domestic animals. He talks about this too. He says, nothing can be done in the way of changing man from a wild into a tame animal without first creating such a breed. But most people are entirely inconsistent in their ideas of what they want created. On the one hand, they feel that all the world's problems would be solved if only there were a wise and good man who would tell everybody what to do. But on the other hand, they bitterly resent being themselves told what to do. As to which of these motives would prevail, it seems at least probable that it would be the resentment, so that if the breed should arise in any manner, it would be extirpated before it could ever become well established. It is, however, imaginable that there might be a part of the world in which the breed was accepted. Now, this is straight out, really, of the New Atlantis by Bacon. He gives this allegorical concept of a place that eventually became America, of course, where they'd have a secret society running the world, although they'd have a form of government on the outside. So he says, make a part of the world in which the breed was accepted, and that this part should gain superiority over the rest of the world, because it could develop various suitable breeds of specialists under the control and direction of the master breed. That's Plato's Republic, and it's the New Atlantis right there. And by the exercise of the skills of these specialists, it might overcome the other nations. So it's appropriate to look a little further into the matter. Imagine that through new discoveries in biology, say by suitably controlled doses of X-rays, which he, by the way, was experimenting with on different tissues, it becomes possible to modify the genes in any desired direction so that heritable changes can be produced in the qualities of some members of the human race. I may say I do not believe this is ever likely to be practical, because there's so many, it's not predictable, that method, you see. It says, but that does not matter as far as concerns the present argument. The first success might be in some physical attribute, for example, by making a breed with longer and stronger legs, so that it could jump a good deal higher than anyone can at present. But passing to more important matters, there might be a breed which could think more abstractly, say a breed of mathematicians, or one that could think more judiciously, say a breed of higher civil servants. And that's who they'll bring in first, by the way, the bureaucrats and the scientists, if they haven't done it already. And the question arises of a more precise prescription for what the qualities of the master breeder are to be. It is usually best to build on what one already has, rather than to start from nothing. So the natural procedure would begin with existing rulers. Existing rulers. Now, I've told you, you have an international club of all those who've got from the top in every country, the long dynasties that have held on to power and their wealth. That's a criteria to get into this club. So this would begin with existing rulers, since these have already established themselves as acceptable to at least a good many of their fellow creatures. One would collect together, say, 100 of the most important present rulers. Among them, of course, should be included a good many who exert secret influence without holding any overt office. Do you know where he got that part from? That's the same thing as Carl Quigley was talking about in Tragedy and Hope and the Anglo-American establishment, when he says those who are on the exoteric in the political scene will not have the true power, says the technocrats, like the Maurice Strongs and these characters, the Brzezinskis, the Kissingers, and a whole host of them would have the real power. That's what he means. So he knew, it was already on the go, you see, when this book was written in the 1950s. Among them, of course, should include a good many who exert secret influence without holding any overt office. That way they're not really, they don't have to answer to the public. And tell them to get on with business of settling what the master breed should be. It's impossible to believe that any such body of men would ever reach agreements on any subject whatsoever, so this plan fails. In a search for the qualities of the master breed, the next idea might be to appeal to the wisdom of our forefathers. Plato and his Republic devotes much attention to this very subject. Why not then find a Plato, give him his group of recruits, and let him educate them for 30 years according to his prescription, though perhaps fortifying it by the findings of modern educational theory? Result should be the master breed. And he says, but this one will not do either, for Plato was not educating the master breed, he was educating the civil servant breed. It's not about these that there's any difficulty, it's the finding of someone to fill the role of Plato himself. It all comes back to the point that we do not know in the remotest degree what we want. But I do not count as an answer the one that would usually be proposed, which would be that the type required should be good and wise, while at the same time showing a special favour for the particular enthusiasms of the proposer. The reason for the impossibility of making a prescription for the master breed is that it's not a breed at all. To call it so is to change the sense of the word. Breeds are specialised for particular purposes, but the essence of masters is that they must not be specialised. You see, they must be wild. That's what he means. Now remember, he and others have written in their books that those who rule the world will not alter themselves with brain chips or anything else. They're not hampered either as they grow up through the educational system we all have. They're impervious to most of the laws because they're wild. He said they must retain their abilities of survival, their capabilities of survival, because they will be steering planet Earth. That's what he means by that. So he says, they have to be able to deal with totally unforeseen conditions, and this is a quality of wild, not of tame, life. No prescription for the master breed is possible. In these considerations, I'm assuming the license of supposing that we might be able, really, to change human nature in a heritable manner. And this is far beyond all probability. Returning now to more practical considerations, there seems no likelihood whatsoever of a master breed arising. All through history, the most formidable difficulty every ruler has been selection of a successor, and the best intentions have been nearly always disappointed. Indeed, it is notably surprising how very seldom the choice has been well made. The immediate cause of these failures has been the difficulty of the subjective judgments on the basis of which the choice must be made, but fundamentally have arisen from a cause in the deep nature of mankind. Of all animals, man, again, you're an animal, you see, is the most ready to try experiments, and there are always candidates, far too many candidates, who regard themselves as fit members for the master breed. This is a message for all those who think they're going to get up there. Who regard themselves as fit members for the master breed, this quality is a characteristic of a wild animal, and it will always prevent man from domesticating himself. He will always prevent the creation of the master breed, through which alone the rest of man could be domesticated. The evolution of the human race will not be accomplished in the 10,000 years of tame animals, but in the million years of wild animals, because man is and will always continue to be a wild animal. He promotes that those at the top should be not subject to the laws of the land or the world. They should be wild. And if you look at a lot of the aristocrats and the lifestyles that they have and the things that they do, they get off with everything because they're naturally wild. And these are the ones who aren't bothered with human decisions too much. They make quick snap decisions. They're wild. That's the type he's favoring here. And he goes into it deeper and deeper in his book. And it's interesting too that you'll find Plato mentioned over and over in all of the Rosicrucians publications. You'll find them talked about by members of the CFR, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Fabian Society, Wells, and many others, always talked about Plato and his Republic being their favourite book. They're giving you a clue, because Plato advised this particular specialised breeding, where those at the top will retain their wildness and survival capabilities, and those down below will be the domestic herd. They're either brought up to strength for wars or culled down in times of peace, and they'll be bred for the particular function in life. And that's exactly where the whole area of eugenics and genetics is being guided today into that very, very thing. And I've been reading from art, from books, from the big players, the guys who gave you the future, who were in all the biggest think tanks of all, and who sat in all the big meetings for the future, going back since the 1920s or more up to the present time. And The Next Million Years is interesting, by Charles Galton Darwin, who wrote this in the 1950s. He himself was a physicist who was really into biology, in fact, rather than physics, and how to basically turn us all into eunuchs, which was his prime. He was very gleeful about that. He got excited when he talked about that. But he was a big player. And when he wrote, it wasn't because he was coming out with these particular imaginings from his own mind. It was because he knew the agenda, he was part of it, and they were already implementing it in the West. I've given you the reports, it's on my site too. You can see the documentary made by the CBC on the fact that most of the males in the Western world are almost sterile. And it's increasing. That's not by chance. You don't put things, artificial hormones, in your food for 50 years without knowing the effects. And they knew the effects of these particular artificial hormones back in the late 1800s. And now, of course, as I say, we've found out about mercury in it as well. And most of the, over half of the items you buy at the supermarket, and it's been there for 40 years. This is war. See, this is how you create war, world war, for an unsuspecting public. What would happen if the public knew at the beginning, when they had all their faculties and their health and their brain power going and their survival capabilities? You'd do something about it very fast. The reason you can publish this stuff today is because it's worked and there's no reaction. It's worked, you see. It's interesting here, in The Next Million Years by Charles Galton Darwin, I'll say the big player, and this is what he said. He's talking about China. He says, sometimes it has been advanced by important new discoveries, such as the invention of printing and so on and so on. At the time, there's been liability to famines in China, all the time, in its whole history, which have killed off millions, it says. The perpetual presence of a margin of starving humanity has set a low value on human life and has made for callousness in regard to the sufferings of the people. I think it's not to say that this has led to much cruelty of the kind we are unfamiliar with, and it, though he mentions the fact we had similar problems during the plague eras of Europe. Starvation was rampant as people stopped farming. They were dying off. Then he says on page 199, he says this. Mind you, he admires the Confucian way, the philosophy. He says it's lasted far longer than any of the philosophies of the West. It would seem that in its constancy of character, both in its virtues and in its defects, the Chinese civilization, listen to this, is to be accepted as the model type of a civilization to a greater degree than on any of the other civilizations of the world. That's what the United Nations says today. Because it doesn't have any sacredness to human life. We don't have it either in the West. We are secular humanists, whether you understand that or not. Look into the meaning, you'll find out that you are. It's been brainwashed into you basically through your education and the media. But it's so interesting to say that these guys wrote about this in the 1950s. In the 1950s, world government. It says here, you're talking about fuel and upcoming fuel problems and how fields would be turned into creating fuel, biofuel, 1950s. Way ahead of what we are told. See, we're living a script, a plan. It's that simple. He says, in this case, North America might fall into four or five provinces and Western Europe into one or two. It's never to be expected there will be any permanence about the numbers of them or about their boundaries. But then he goes into the setting up of a complete North American Union and a European Union as well. And what happens then, and beyond that too. Back with more after this break. Hi, folks, I'm Alan Watt. We're cutting through the matrix. I'm trying to show people how we're guided through plans that were made long ago, published, and discussed at big top-level meetings, not really so much in secrecy. They always mention something in newspapers. They don't tell you the content, the actual real content of the meetings, but books do come out, which are generally ignored by the general public. They're not terribly exciting or sexy, and we're given lots of trivia to divert us into other things, or crisis, which they keep throwing at us too, to keep us off balance. It's important to keep people off balance when you're taking them down. Very important, just like boxing. And Sir Charles Galton Darwin, this great benefactor of mankind, talks about world government. And he said, in page 192, it is too much to expect that there could ever be a permanent world government. Benevolently treating all of them on a perfect equality, such an institution could only work during the rare occasions of a worldwide golden age. He's talking about total employment and so on. But then he goes into talking about how the government really works. He says there will inevitably be ill feeling and jealousy between the provinces. There's some of the world being split into provinces, with each believing that it's not getting its fair share of the good things, and in fact would be like the state of affairs with which we are all too familiar. If then there is there ever going to be a world government, it will have to function as governments do now. So he's very pragmatic and honest, in the sense that it will have to coerce a minority, and indeed it might often be a majority, into doing things they do not want to do. That's the real purpose of government, because there's a different agenda than you know. And here's a guy who tells governments, or told governments, what to do. He and the groups that he belonged to, the Royal Society, Royal Institute for International Affairs, and the CFR, and so on. And then he goes into this in page 191. If the fuel problem, this is the 1950s, is solved completely, you start growing biofuels and so on, so that mechanical power and transportation is available in the future to a greater extent than the present, then the provinces will be large. For example, the whole of Europe may well be one, and the whole of North America another. You see? He also goes through the entire agenda of coming starvations in different regions of the world, including the West, by the way. And that is on the cards, because if you look into, and I've mentioned this many times before, the guys who are in charge of monitoring the world's food supply and setting up all the institutions to deal with the world's food supply, is the Royal Institute for International Affairs. Look into their website. They've been at this for at least 15 years full-time, with many different think tanks and workers working on the coming food shortages. It's all planned that way, because after all, they plan to bring the population down to a very small number. And he tells you in this book, the ones who are going to survive, they're going to be the high scientific elite, the ones who have no problems denying any deities or superstitions of any kind. They'll be pragmatic people who are the intellectual class, basically. And he's absolutely confident that through genetic manipulation, they can better the race that will serve them. And that's where we are now, on the race towards creating a population of perfect servants. That's what it's all about in genetic engineering, the Human Genome Project and everything. That's why it's been rushing full steam ahead for years, because it was on the agenda. That's why. And they were doing it long before we heard of it. Long before we heard of it. It's far older than Dolly the Sheep. Far, far older. That's the rubbish they feed the public. It says here, this is the future that's coming up. Those who find the bad conditions of work supportable will be willing to work harder and for less reward. In a broad sense of the term, they're more efficient than the others because they get more done for less pay. There are, of course, many exceptions, for real skill will get its reward, but in the long run it is inevitable that the lower types of labour will have an exceedingly precarious life. One of the triumphs of our own golden age has been that slavery has been abolished over a great part of the earth. It's difficult to see how this condition can be maintained in the hard world of the future with its starving margins, and it's to be feared that all too often a fraction of humanity will have to live in a state which, whatever it may be called, will be indistinguishable from slavery. Very pragmatic, you see. I mean, he's being honest, isn't he? They're making this happen. This is the agenda. This is the agenda. He also talks about those who will run the cultures, which they already do. He says, maybe guess it will be what I call the mountaineers. He's talking about the people who will own the top mountainous areas of the planet. Very important part of this whole agenda. Because over the last 20 years, the wealthy people have been buying up old ski resorts and everything. But especially if they have rivers near them. He's talking about coming hydroelectric power that will power the world. And whole areas of the earth set aside for creating power and energy for the rest. That's what's happening right now. This was 50 years before we heard of it. And he published this. He says, and those who will become dominant through their wealth, they will tend to have the highest culture, since culture most easily comes from the leisure created by wealth. Only the leisure class can go ahead with their culture. We simply adopt what we see. You should see, as the king goes and the queen goes, we all adopt their fashions, their style, and even their mode of speaking, in fact, which is more prevalent in England than anywhere else. So there's nothing new under the sun, nothing new at all. Even talks about the need to start pushing for population control all over the Western world, and I'll go into this after this break. Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt. We're cutting through the matrix. Talking about very unpleasant things, but that's what you have to know if you truly do want to alter the world in a different direction, and you want at least humanity to survive, at least those around you, their offsprings, or someone, you know, offsprings to survive what's coming. Otherwise, you can just bury your head in the sand and bewail yourself, bemoan what's happening around you, which is all planned. It truly is all planned this way. And I've been talking, too, about what's happening in China. Just don't worry about them, because China has had thousands of years of dealing with population control. Thousands of years. Again, Huxley goes into this in great detail, or Sir Charles Galton Darwin, I should say. You get them confused because they're like clones of each other in a literal sense, because they spiel all the same stuff. It's all the same topics, because this is their favorite hobbies, you see. And they all belong to the same associations, the ones that still run the world today. In page 183, he says, now here's where he gets really excited. It's in the biological sciences that the most exciting possibilities suggest themselves, perhaps because biology has only recently shown rapid advances like those made earlier in the inorganic sciences. I'll only speculate on a few among these possibilities which might have great effects on human life. These really talk about culling off the people. You understand how they word things. I've already referred to the possibility of quite new sources of food, and I need not enlarge on that further. He doesn't go into that because he knew darn well they're going to genetic modification a long time ago. Another type of discovery may be connected with hormones. This is very interesting. Those internal chemical secretions which so largely regulate the operations of the human body. The artificial use of hormones has already been shown to have profound effects on the behavior of animals, and it seems quite possible that hormones, or perhaps drugs, might have similar effects on man. And I'll repeat what I said earlier, look into my website and look at the link to the video from the CBC on the fact that humanity in the West is going sterile because of these artificial hormones we've been consuming in our foods for about 50 years. Around the time this was written, in fact. The artificial use of hormones has been shown to profound effects on the behavior of animals, and it's quite possible that hormones, or perhaps drugs, may have similar effects on men. You can't tell this guy apart, really, from the Huxleys. And they all knew each other very, very well, because they all belonged to the same clubs, you see. For example, there might be a drug which, without other harmful effects, removed the urgency of sexual desire and so reproduced in humanity the status of workers in a beehive. Isn't that a wonderful objective to go for, isn't it? Or there might be another drug that produced a permanent state of contentment in the recipient. After all, alcohol does something like this already, although it has other disadvantages and is only temporary in its effects. He was looking for a permanent effect, you see. A dictator would certainly welcome the compulsory administration of the contentment drug to his subjects. Aldous Huxley said the same thing. Why? Because they're all at the same meetings, you see, when they planned introducing the stuff into the food supplies of the peoples. Which is another possible, and this is interesting too, the rather remoter discovery suggests that the most curious consequences, that this is the control of the relative numbers of the two sexes. You know, I was talking about China earlier and how they have more males and females, you don't have to worry about it. It says that the sex of a child is carried by the sperm, not the ovum. And it's least imaginable that some method could be found for sorting out those of the sperm cells which carry the male or the female character. It would thus become possible to regulate how many men or women there should be in a population. These guys are utter control freaks. Utter control freaks. But this is the utopia they're talking about. And they can bring it off, by the way. They're already almost there. If such a practice could be developed, it is sure that for a time there would be a great unbalance in populations. A nation with ambitions for conquest would produce a large number of men for its soldiers, but would pay for it by not having enough women to give birth to the soldiers for succeeding generations, so short-term for that purpose. On the other hand, just as a stockbreaker keeps few bulls and many cows, another nation might decide that it needed few men in order to maintain its numbers. Would such a predominantly female population be able to stand up against the male one, or would a rape of the Sabine woman rectify the disproportions? It is clear that the most remarkable effects will be produced if such developments in biological science should come about, and it's quite impossible to conjecture how they will turn out. I can only record the opinion that in the long run, their efforts will mainly cancel out, for the reason I've developed in an earlier chapter, that man is and will continue to be a wild animal. To produce effects of these kinds, there must be a master, and the master must be above and not subject to the procedure he is enforcing on his subjects. They understand the elite don't eat what we eat. They don't get the inoculations that we get. See, what he's talking about here was already starting in his time and being introduced on the population. And they could not tell the population who they referred to as he did too. He always compares you to the animals. That's all we are to them, as animals. We're animals. So to repeat that last part, to produce effects of this kind, of these kinds, there must be a master, and the master must be above and not subject to the procedure he's enforcing on his subjects. The dictator could not afford himself to take the contentment drug, because if he did so, his capacity for rule would certainly degenerate. It always comes back to the same point, that to carry out any policy systematically in such a way as permanently to influence the human race, there would have to be a master breed of humanity, not itself exposed to the conditions it is inducing in the rest. The master breed, being wild animals, would be subject to all the fashions, tastes, and passions of humanity as we know it, and so would never have the constancy to establish for generation after generation a consistent policy which could materially alter the nature of mankind. In connection with the recent wonderful advances in medical science, this is the place to mention a matter that will very soon indeed be of immediate importance. Since a normal condition of the world, there will be a margin of every population on the verge of starvation, it seems likely that there will have to be a revision of the doctrine of the sanctity of the individual human life. And that's what we're seeing now. I mentioned this blitz is on for a month, maybe the follow-up for 1 or 2 months, or maybe even 3 months, on the need to depopulate fast. This is all from the same institutions and the foundations who fund them, as Huxley and Charles Gorton Darwin belong to. It seems likely that it will have to be a revision of the doctrine of the sanctity of the individual human life. What the United Nations said, that the individual is the enemy. We are one, right? We're all one. One big hunk of animals, basically, according to these boys at the top. And if we're individuals and maybe believe in the sanctity of the individual human life, obviously we're an enemy to this agenda. That's why we've got to all be one. And don't look at the nasty things in life. Be happy. Just be happy. Take the contentment drug. And the New Age religions are just that too. They're contentment drugs. It says, in the old days, the doctors were under the obligation of doing all they could to preserve any life, though they had no great success in their efforts. Now it's hardly too much to say that most diseases have come under control, or anyhow, to judge by recent progress, most of them soon will. But is the world the better for having a large number of healthy people dying of starvation rather than letting them die of malaria? That's why they withdrew DDT, by the way. One of the justified boasts of recent times has been the great decrease that medicine has made in infant mortality. Whereas in the old days, a mother might bear 10 children and have only 2 survive, now she may bear only 3, and she'll be regarded as very unlucky if all do not survive. But the difficulty in the world is going to be that the number of people born is too great for the food supplies, so that a fraction must die anyhow. May it not be better than they should die in infancy? One of the biggest industries we've got is the abortion industry. And we think nothing of it. It says here, the truth is that all our present codes about the sanctity of human life are based on the security of life as it is at present. And once that is gone, it will inevitably be revised. And the revision will probably shock most of our present opinions. What wouldn't shock him, because he was in the planning of it. Governments have been at war with farmers since before and during and after World War II. They've paid them not to grow stuff, to keep prices up. They gave them little freebies to get them, like tax-exempt things and so on, which they fell for. They always give them a bait and they fall for it. Then governments come in and start dictating what they can do and what they can't do. Then start going under, going out of business, too much hassle. The big corporations that own the whole agricultural industries now, but 5 of them across the planet, have the world's food supply in their hands, and they also belong to the same societies as Sir Charles Galton Darwin and all the rest of that ilk. So they're bringing all this about, you see. Because remember, they want to bring us down to almost about 500,000 people in the perfect utopia. And they've worked intergenerationally for hundreds of years on the same agenda to make it so. It talks about, in fact, the creation of the big pharma industries, as the farmers go out. It says, the general picture of the economic condition of the world, then, is that the chief centres of power production, and so of the most elaborate civilization, will be the regions where there is water power, that is, speaking rather loosely, mountainous regions. It will be these that are the centres of manufacture, and they will exchange their manufacturers for surplus food produced in the agricultural regions. There will also be large power farms in various parts of the world storing energy, either by some direct mechanism or through the intermediary of, he's talking about vegetables, literally growing vegetables for fuel, like corn and so on. Grain. Astonishing, eh? And we think, if we're told by the media, which is owned by the same corporations that run these guys, still today, that we're just bumbling through time here and politicians are trying their best to just deal with the crisis that suddenly came out of nowhere, unexpectedly. It's astonishing. Then he talks about creeds. Creeds are religions. Remember what Bertrand Russell said. There's no nonsense so arrant that it cannot be made. The creed, the belief of the vast majority by adequate government action. That was Lord Bertrand Russell, a great power, these boys, all working for the same Royal Society. So that's what using, creating a eugenic creed. It says here, is it possible that there should arise a eugenic creed? This is page 203. Which, perhaps working through what I've called the method of unconscious selection, should concern itself with improvement of the inherent nature of man, instead of resting content with merely giving him good but impermanent acquired characters. Without such a creed, man's nature will only be changed through the blind operation of natural selection. With it, he might aspire to do something towards really changing his destiny. To conclude, I've cited the past history of China as furnishing the type of an enduring civilization. It seems to provide a model to which the future history of the world may be expected broadly to conform. Isn't it astonishing, as I say, that from the CFR and their publications, the magazine, Foreign Relations Magazine, they call it, and from the United Nations and all through academia, all they've been doing is parroting this man for the last 50-odd years with his great visions of the future, which he didn't say came through a crystal ball or reading the stars. It came because that was the agenda already set out and sworn to by oaths. And we're simply living through their plan. So China was to be a model to which the future history of the world may be expected broadly to conform. The scale will, of course, be altogether vaster, and the variety of happenings cannot by any means be foreseen. I believe that the underlying ground theme can be foreseen, and in a general way it would be rather like the history of the Chinese Empire. The regions of the world, will fall into provinces of ever-changing extent. Now, you see that with the European Union. It keeps altering the numbers within it. See, they're even up to this present step. They've got the amalgamated Americas in here from the 1950s. It's got the European Union completed, basically. It says they're not going to a phase of alteration between getting larger and smaller as different provinces fall away for a century or two, or they're left to die, basically, because they can't produce enough. In that kind of scenario. And how they'll actually compete with each other. That's what we're told right now, that North America must amalgamate to compete with Europe and China. Well, how can you compete with the wages in China and live in the climates we live in? You can't do it. And they know this. And so should we. We should all think about this too when we hear these silly comments about competing with China from our politicians or the CFR guys who come out openly now telling us we have to. The same guys who drafted up the amalgamation for the Americas. We've got to go and compete with China. He goes on to say here, but I believe that the underlying ground theme can be foreseen, and that in general way we rather like the history of the Chinese Empire. The regions of the world will fall into provinces of ever-changing extent, which most of the time will be competing against one another. It's amazing how they write it all that time ago. Occasionally, more rarely, and as would be the case in China, they'll be united by some strong arm into an uneasy world government, which will endure for a period until it falls by the inevitable decay that finally destroys all dynasties. Now, I've read the reports from the think tanks for the projections for the next 30 to 50 years, from the US think tank, for the military think tank, and the British one for NATO, and they've taken everything from this book, from the 1950s. Because they also said that civilization could unite for a while and then fall apart. It's intended to fall apart and go under through riots and deprivation and famine, that's why. But in the end run, there'll always be pockets of very high-tech civilization. That's what they all said, and that's what he's saying in this book as well. Only he was way ahead of them. So sometimes we're united into an uneasy world government, which will endure for a period until it falls by the inevitable decay that finally destroys all dynasties. We'll be back with more of this after this break. Hi, folks. I'm Alan Watt. We're cutting through the matrix and showing you how everything is laid out. One big agenda, one big business plan, and how we are simply living generation through generation, right through the whole planet itself. And it's all, everything you read today is reiteration of the big players and what they published 50 to 100 years ago. It's the same organization running the world today, the same boys who set up China, the same guys who drafted up the GATT treaties and made China the most favored nation, trading nation status, gave it to them. They created communism for China as well, because it's not real communism at all. It's an oligarch in China, and science rules over China and pragmatism. As I say, pragmatism is a very important word to use when dealing with these particular characters. They talked about creating a eugenic creed, a belief system, that perhaps would be to train the people, or make the people believe that they had to perish to save the few. And also training the elite to have more children as a sacred duty, to pass on the better genes to the surviving species, you see. It's astonishing, and that's exactly where we're going, and it even gives you hints of the green movement it created 50-odd years ago. A creed, a belief system. And you have all these greenies parroting the stuff that's been handed to them, thinking it's their own idea. It talks about after the world government, because that's only part of the strategy. That's the end of the chess game. And then afterwards, they have pockets of civilization, high tech, that will survive across the planet. And he goes on to it here. He says, there will be periods when some of the provinces relapse into barbarism. And that's what we're hearing about now from the big think tanks, repeating the same stuff that he wrote about, he and others of his kind, wrote about 50 years ago. The coming riots, the food riots, according to the big military think tanks, advisors to the military in Europe and the US and Canada. But all the time, civilization will survive, and some of them, it will survive because it will be based on a single universal culture, derived from the understanding of science. For it's only through this understanding that the multitudes can continue to live. On this basic culture, there will be overlaid other cultures, often possessing a greater emotional appeal, which will vary according to climate and race from one province to another. Most of the time, and over most of the earth, there will be severe pressure from excess populations, and there will be periodic famines. That's what's coming up, and it's all over the CFR's websites, because they're planning all this stuff. They call it managing it. They're managing the coming problems with food. There will be a consequent callousness about the value of the individual's life. We're getting hammered with that now. You're nothing. Apathy. As Bertrand Russell says, you've got to create apathy. And often there will be cruelty to a degree which we do not willingly think. They're tasering the people and all the rest of it. There's nothing for cops to shoot folk anymore. This, however, is only one side of the history. On the other side, there will be vast stores of learning, far beyond anything we can now imagine, and the intellectual stature of man will rise to ever higher levels. And sometimes new discoveries will, for a time, relieve the human race from its fears, and there will be golden ages, ages plural, where man may, for a time, be free to create wonderful flowerings in science, philosophy, and the arts. Isn't that just dandy? Doesn't that make you feel better now? And that all this sacrifice is worth it. We'll sleep well tonight, won't we? Because these monsters are truly in charge of the world and all academia and all of the governments, and they advise all the governments through the same think tanks and the front organizations they have. Here he is pushing eugenics, of course, throughout the whole book. He's talking about creeds. Now, creeds are belief systems. Now, here they are. They have to remove God and all the rest of it from religion. And that's why they're hammering the Middle East right now. This is a war on Islam, believe it or not. This is a war on Islam. They must remove God from everything so they can replace it with their own doctrine. There can be no gods before them. That's their motto. You see? And let's say this little saying from Bertrand Russell. He says, there's no nonsense so arrant, that means ridiculous, that it cannot be made the creed, the belief of the vast majority by adequate government action. And here's his pal here, Charles Galton Darwin, writing this. He said, he's talking about creeds. He says, though the majority of the population, say something like 9/10, accept their creed implicitly, and regard it as part of the law of nature, there will always be a small minority who do not. Most people call them sheep, who follow the ideas of the leaders unquestioningly, but this minority, the goats, a goat, you see, is a real wild sheep, it's not been domesticated, goes by contraries and disbelieves everything just because those around him believe it. Then going down the book, he says, because he's talking about sustainable development, in future history, the constancy of human nature makes it certain that man will continue to be dominated by enthusiasm for beliefs of one kind or another. You will be persecuted again and again for the sake of ideas, some of which later ages will seem of no importance and even unintelligible. But there is one much more valuable aspect of creeds that must be noticed. They serve to give a continuity to policy. To policy, remember, far greater than can be usually attained by intellectual conviction. In other words, he's talking about the using a creed, creating a creed, a belief system that would last for generations, because simply persuasion by itself could only last about one generation. And I'm talking here about what you hear today of the greening movement, because that's what they planned to bring in. It would be taught in schools. It would be have all the aspects and attributes of a religion. And it should last for generations. Sustainability. It ties in the eradication and sterilization, etc., of whole populations, which he mentions in his book, the one I'm reading from, The Next Million Years. Quite the boast, eh? So repeat that. There's one much more valuable aspect of creeds that must be noticed. They serve to give a continuity to policy. Whose policy? Their policy. Far greater than can usually be attained by intellectual conviction. There are many cases in the history of enlightened statesmen who have devoted their lives to carrying through some measures for the general good. They may have succeeded only to find that the next generation neglects all they have done, so that it becomes undone again in favor of some other quite different way of benefiting humanity. You understand, they're doublespeak. They're talking from their own points of view in the managed society. It is the intellectual adoption of a policy thus often hardly survives more than a single generation, and this is too short a period for such a policy to overcome the tremendous effects of pure chance. But if the policy can arouse enough enthusiasm to be incorporated in a belief system, then there is at least a prospect that it will continue for something like 10 generations, and that's long enough to give it a fair probability of success. Back to this break. Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix, showing you that the events you've lived through in your life were all planned that way. You thought the abortion industry just came out on its own because women were demanding it? No, they were funded by big foundations that trace back to one major foundation in the US and one in Britain. And all the other ones were fronts, well-funded, because this is a policy. A policy, not just a sustained development, as they call it, like development as they sustain it. This is to reduce the population into manageable size. It was planned an awful, awful long time ago. I'm reading The Next Million Years again by a big player in this who knew it was already on the go in subversive ways, very stealth mode ways back in his own time. That's when he started when the sperm count started dropping around 1950s when he was writing this book. It says here on page 149, it's clear from all this that the world policy, and remember he's making it quite plain because this belongs to the Royal Institute for International Affairs, a world policy, would need to be supported by international sanctions, and the only ultimate sanction must be war. You realize how many people have been killed off with wars, and it creates famines and all the rest of it too. Present methods of warfare would not be nearly murderous enough to reduce populations seriously. That came out from the King's Inquisition inquiry or commission into depopulation right after World War II, which this guy would be at. He'd attended it. So war is not murderous enough to bring us down, you see, to what they want us to. And even so, they would take a nearly equal toll of victims from the unoffending nation. So after the war, the question arises of how to reduce the excess population of the offending nation. It's not possible to be humane in this, but the most humane method would seem to be infanticide, together with the sterilization of a fraction of the adult population. Such sterilization could now be done without the brutal methods practiced in the past, but it would certainly be vehemently resisted. Of course it would, so they've done it stealthily, you see. These guys are no dummies. And when they read these big world meetings that these guys attend, don't make wish lists and hope we'll all come to their point of view. They go ahead and do it by stealth. He says, I've dwelt on these details, perhaps at unnecessary length, not because I believe they will ever happen, but in order to show that this kind of enforcement, which is the only obvious one, would lead to a condition of strife, jealousy, and disorder, which is precisely the condition that was designed to avoid. Then he goes in on how to introduce it worldwide, step by step. Whose main enemies would be, he talks about the churches, etc., and how they'd have to overcome them, and on it goes. It's quite astonishing to realize that these monsters have been running our lives, and our parents' lives, and grandparents' lives. And it's quickly said in his own book, Tragedy and Hope, and he was all for this group, he was a member of it, he said they've been behind every major war in the 20th century, and I could say they're also been behind the one in the 21st century as well, because it's all according to the mandates they set up an awful long time ago. They've never deviated from the plans they laid down and published like 100 years ago. Never a deviation. Even their time limits, they're right on time, right on schedule with everything. And that's the bad news. But you don't know your enemy. You can't fight it unless you know who it is.
From myself, Alan Ward, it's good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.